did a mission for it. Got like a, I think 8 or 9 science instruments on board, and I'm not too familiar with them, but that should be a very good mission. It's not like Galileo was. Galileo had a RTG on board, radioisotope thermal electric generator, plutonium basically, to produce enough heat to create the electricity for Galileo. We've gotten much better over the decades at bigger solar panels and higher efficiency with solar panels. So the solar panels, there's three long panels that open up. They're quite long, I think, end-to-end, probably 120 feet or something. But they're going to produce, you know, they would produce a lot of wattage here if they were going, you know, around Earth, but Jupiter's pretty far out, a billion miles, I think, or half a billion miles out. So, that half a billion miles out, inverse square law, gets you down to 400 watts. But they have plenty of ampere, I think 50 or 60 ampere batteries on board to keep it going. That's all I know about Juno, Dick. Back to that WS line.
When it reaches Jupiter, June of this year, 2016, and it's going to be going into a polar orbit, as it reaches Jupiter, it would be doing a gravity assist flyby, and it would be leaving Jupiter faster than it entered the Jupiter environment, if it doesn't do a retro burn. So there's probably going to be, I'm going to pick a number, a 10-minute burn of a rocket engine on Juno as it gets to the North Pole area of Jupiter in order to enter orbit around Jupiter. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
It'll slow itself down, but I think it comes in like hot, you know, like 100,000 miles an hour, some bizarre number by the time it gets there. It's really accelerating. So they have to slow it down, but there's going to be a series of aero braking, I think, is involved with this one. I'll have to check. But yeah, that burn, I think originally was going to be July 4th of this year, not June. I'll have to check to see if they changed. Maybe we got there early. If it's June, Dick. I didn't know it was June. I thought it was supposed to be July 4th, I thought. Or the 14th. I don't know. I haven't checked it lately. Back to Dick.
Well, it sounds to me like it's got a heat shield on it, Paul. And it's going to be entering the atmosphere, the upper atmosphere of Jupiter, and using aero braking. Is that the main method of entering orbit? Aero braking, as opposed to a rocket engine? Over you, Paul, K2RIW.
Oh, it's gonna slow itself down with some kind of rocket, with thrusters or something. I'll have to look at the details on it. But it doesn't need heat shields. When they do aero braking, they just lightly touch the atmospheres. For instance, Odyssey did that when it went into orbit around Mars. It slowed itself down, and that doesn't have any kind of heat resistant anything on it. And that worked quite well, but it took a long time to do it. You know, probably 6 months or something. So, I'll have to see if this is any kind of air. I'll have to check. I don't want to say anything until I check if it's going to be aero braking. I don't remember the panels being angled. Usually when it's aero braking, they use the panels as a wing to some degree. If you look at Mars Odyssey, it's like that. By the way, Mars Odyssey is still functioning. And it's something 15 years now. Since 2001. So they're doing real good with some of these spacecraft that they expect last couple of years. And here it is 15 years later. It's still, they're using it as a repeater too for the rovers that are down there riding around. Back to you, Dick.
The space shuttle needed as much thrust and as much fuel as you could pack onto that spacecraft, into that external tank and in the internal tanks and so on. I'm guessing the highest density fuels that we know of, most energy per pound or energy per cubic meter, were liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. These modern spacecraft by Elon Musk, are using this refined kerosene plus liquid oxygen. Why was that choice made? It's because the fuel is cheaper, even though the energy density is a little bit lower, and maybe those engines are designed for that fuel. What made them flip over to a refined kerosene instead of oxygen and hydrogen, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
I know the, like the Atlas has been using it for decades, refined kerosene. So that's, you know, NASA really, you have companies like SpaceX probably just following that lead, I would think, but I don't know. It's less complicated, I would think, to use RP-1. Hydrogen is much harder to contain. You know, I mean, in the second stage of the Atlas rocket that, you know, that pushed Juno to Jupiter, they used the Centaur. Now, the Centaurs are liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. So whether they'll eventually have that involved with SpaceX, I don't think so. But there's other plans. You know, you have other companies. You have Blue Orbit, for instance. They just landed their suborbital spacecraft called New Shepard for the third time. They launched it, went into space, came back, and landed in Texas. Let me drop it. They have something called the BE-3, the BE-3 rocket, and that's using liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. So that's what they chose to run with. Now they're going up to another rocket. They're now contracted with the United Launch Alliance to build the next rocket engine for their future rocket called the Vulcan. Flying by 2019, I think, was the earliest. And that rocket, even so, you know, the BE-3 that they're using now, it's just one rocket going up to suborbital space and bringing it down. And by the way, they're going to have passages within a couple of years on that thing. That's the ultimate goal, 6 passages on that rocket. The BE-4, you would think, well, okay, it's a BE-3. Going to go to a BE-4, they're going to use hydrogen. No, they're going to use liquid methane. That's the plan. So that's the new thing now. Liquid methane for the BE-4, and that'll be used for the new Vulcan rocket. So why they choose one over the other? Availability, for instance, the methane choice, they don't have to use extra pressurization from an inert gas such as helium. That's now off the table. Blue Origin won't need that. So there's certain advantages and disadvantages of each. Elon Musk eventually might go to liquid methane as well. Wait a minute now. There's a possibility that one of them, I think Blue Origin, might also be developing the BE-4 with liquid natural gas. So we'll see. They're not coming out yet, but we'll keep you updated on what they're doing. So why do they pick one over the other? They all have one thing in common though. That's liquid oxygen. So that I could say. That's the commonality. Maybe it's cost. Sometimes it's how long you can keep it on launch pad. If there's going to be a delay, maybe some are more difficult than others. I don't know, Dick. It's hard enough trying to memorize which one goes with what. Back to you.
the refined kerosene, which I think you've been calling it RP-1, if I cryogenically cool it just above the freezing temperature, I can pack more of it into that tank on the launch pad. And the liquid oxygen, I don't know whether or not that's being cooled to even below the liquefying temperature. Maybe it's also being cooled to the close to the freezing temperature to get maximum density in the tank. After you leave the launch pad and those tanks are half empty, now you've got a lot of space left over. You don't have to worry about cryogenically cooling the RP-1. Let it go to the full volume, if you know what I mean, because there's already a lot of empty space in that tank. And the only cryogenic tank left is the oxygen. So I can see how life is a lot less complicated if the only cryogenic liquid fuel on board is the liquid oxygen. So you get good insulation on that tank. You don't need fantastic insulation on the RP-1 tank. And now you can let that sit in orbit as long as you want and then do a retro burn at some later time. So is that a possible scenario? And are they cooling the liquid oxygen below normal temperatures to pack it in tighter on the launch pad pole? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, SpaceX with their Falcon 9 is doing that with both the fuel and the oxygen. They're bringing their temperatures down, whatever the original temperatures were for their earlier flights. They're bringing the RP-1 50 degrees below to be able to get 20% more or something fuel in the rocket. The same thing with the liquid oxygen. Now, they're the only ones that are doing it. ULA, United Launch Alliance, have been launching rockets with RP-1 on it forever, and they thought about it years ago, and they said, you know what, it's not worth it. It's just not worth it. I think their theory is maybe build a bigger rocket or something, but it's just not worth it to go through this extra trouble. And there's also a fueling problem. You know, you have to load these fuels, these cryogenically fuels, kind of like the last minute, you know, the last 30 minutes of before a flight, you know, they start loading the fuel, where if it's not cool to these densified temperatures that they're doing now, they have a little bit more time. So if there's a delay and a hold for 10-15 minutes, you know, the old system, hey, we'll let it sit there a little bit longer, then we'll go. This system, you know, the window of opportunity is much shorter. I think that's what happened. I think it was one of the scrubs last time. They had a problem like that, if I'm not mistaken. Back to you, Dick.
And with these super cooled fuels, let me drop into the deep. With these super cooled fuels, if you do have a scrubbed mission, does that mean you have to empty those tanks and start all over again, Paul? Over to you, K2RIW.
That's what I heard, and that's what they did. I saw them do that during the. They had about four scrubs on the last mission. So we'll see. Now SpaceX has two more missions coming up, and the next two from Cape Canaveral anyway will be geosynchronous orbits, which means instead of the first stage booster going at 4,000 miles an hour, it's getting close to, and then eventually above 8,000 miles per hour. So it's much more difficult to slow the engine down. And in fact, Elon Musk was talking about it. He says the speed of the rocket, as far as when these things start to heat up, when they start coming through the atmosphere, is cubed compared to the speed. You know, twice the speed, the heat is going to be cubed. So it's much more difficult, not only for slowing it down from 8,000 miles down to 4 miles an hour, instead of 4,000 miles down to 4 miles an hour. It's a heating problem. So those two flights should be interesting. They're going to be on a barge. The next CRS cargo resupply mission will be, you know, for the International Space Station. Probably, I guess, June or July. Probably July, I'm going to guess. Right now, it's actually time to go up exactly as, you know, equal to the next Cygnus launch. So I guess they're going to be fighting it out who goes up first. They can't launch on the same day. Actually, they probably could. They wanted to. One's going from Florida, the other one's going from Virginia. But the next CRS mission will be the one taking the IDA up, the International Docking Adapter. And that flight, he has already said that they'll be flying that directly back to the Cape. He brought up another landing zone. They call it Landing Zone 1 now, instead of what it used to be called, Launch Complex 13. So that's where they landed it last time in December, the end of last year. That's where they landed the first booster. By the way, that one's going to be on display in California eventually. It's got to get the approval from the FAA to display there. He's very close to an airport where his main building is. So he doesn't want this 155-foot thing sticking up out of the ground without the approval of the FAA. But once he gets that, that's going to go on display. The one that came back now, he's going to relaunch. We'll see how that goes. So, I don't know, Dick. Plenty of things going on. I mean, there's no end to it. China's involved with things. India now is very shortly, within a month or so, maybe even less than a month, they're going to be launching a prototype shovel type of thing, very small, but a prototype. They're planning on reusability as well. That's the name of the game, reusability. Everybody's going with that.
Sounds good. In the case of the space shuttle, the external tank had liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen at very cold cryogenic temperatures, and the insulation on those tanks was less than ideal. Therefore, the outside of that external tank built up, it built up ice. What looked like ice, it really was called cryopumping. The air hitting that insulation got cooled to a cryogenic temperature. The air turned into a liquid. The air became more compact, soaked into the foam, and more air came in and touched it again and became more liquid and so on. A kind of a runaway condition. And when that frozen air inside of that air, inside of the foam on the outside of the external tank breaks away during launch and then hits the fins on the solid rocket booster, it was doing damage. And I guess it could also hit the leading edge of the wing of the space shuttle. In the case of this greater cooling going on now with the latest vehicles, what stops the ice buildup on the outside of that vehicle from creating these problems, Paul? Now, maybe the good news is there's no wings or fins or whatever below the tank, and therefore, even though ice builds up and breaks away, it's not doing any damage. So you would think these greater cryo temperatures would exacerbate this cryo pumping of liquefying air into the foam insulation. Over to you, Paul, KQRIW.
Yeah, I know. Well, you look at those launches, they're pretty clean. I don't see anything falling off it. Like you said, there's nothing below it. It's like the old days, you know, the Saturn V, you know, we had rockets on top of the thing. We didn't have it mounted on the way the space shuttle was. So I guess they didn't think that was a problem when they designed it. Of course, now we know that it turned out to be a very serious problem. It killed a lot of people. So, time marches on. You know, well, there is a small space shuttle type of design being built by Sierra Nevada, and that's called Dream Chaser. Originally designed for a crew, and they're now getting paid to do it as a cargo mission. They've got a contract now with NASA to do that. So they'll be flying. They'll eventually be flying on the Atlas V rocket to the space station. Probably within, I wouldn't be surprised if that was 2 years from now. And then probably further down the log, they're going to have a, I'm sure they'll develop a system for a crew. If the cargo system works out. Originally, they wanted to do cargo, and then, people, and they had to switch to cargo. I think eventually they're going to have both. That's going to be an interesting deal. You're going to see this thing coming back on a runway. Pretty good for a private company. We're doing it with the X-37B. We're doing that now with the military, but to see a private company do that, going up to the space station, wow.
Time marches on. In the United States press, we hear nothing about what the Chinese space program is doing. I seem to remember an earlier space report, Paul. You told us that the Chinese have put up a number of missions, manned missions. I think you told me that they even put up a small version of the space station. I think it's not occupied now. So here's my set of questions about other space agencies. What's the total number of manned missions that you know of that China has launched? Have they put up a space station? Do they intend to put up another one? Has Germany put up anything? Has India put up anything? What other nations, Japan, what other nations are putting up manned missions? And once again, in China, what's the total number of space station-like things that China has put up? WS2N with our space report, K2RIW in the TechNet, you got a ball.
Well, China, of course, has the capability of sending people to space. They've done it, I guess, a half a dozen different times so far. They have a new space station going to be launched this summer. And then they're going to have crews going to it, you know, three people at a time. So they're involved with that. I mean, they even have an unmanned craft that's coming back. They launched this, I think, a day or two ago. China did the Xijian, it's S-H-I-J-I-A-N 10 spacecraft. They have all kinds of experiments on board. They'll stay up there probably a couple of weeks, and then deorbit, come back and land in the Gobi Desert in Mongolia. So, you know, that's coming back on a parachute and gonna land just like an unmanned spacecraft. But they have the capability of launching crews. India has a manned space program that they're developing. Not too long ago, they launched the equivalent of a mock-up spacecraft. They were able to launch it, have it come back, land in the Indian Ocean. So they have plans of doing it. You asked about Germany. Well, that's part of the European Space Agency. They always wanted to do this. Costs were prohibitive. Originally, when they built the Ariane 5 rocket, which still launches today, it's a heavy lift rocket from Kourou, French Guiana, down in South America. They originally had plans of launching something called the HERMS. It was going to be like a small space shuttle type of thing, like a Dream Chaser almost. Very small, with only a two-person crew. But the cost got prohibitive, and they dropped that. So they'd love to do it, and I think they're thinking about contracting with Dream Chaser to eventually do something that like that, maybe somewhere down the road. Not launch on the Ariane 5, but they're building something called the Ariane 6 new rocket, and I wouldn't be surprised if eventually they do something like that. They already got a contract with Sierra Nevada to, with the Dream Chaser to build a cargo piece that attaches to it. there's a multi-million dollar thing that's going to be attached to the back of a Dream Chaser. So a Dream Chaser will have the capability to dock with the International Space Station. I mean dock or berth, either or. And they'll be able to unload cargo. They'll be able to bring back scientific equipment, old spacesuits, whatever they want, put it on top of, put it inside the Dream Chaser. But this cargo thing that they're going to attach to the back that the European Space Agency is presently building, will be able to load it up with trash and stuff. So then when it deorbits from the space station, now they already got contracts with the International Space Station to do this. I mean, with NASA to do this for the space station. So now they'll be able to deorbit from the space station. So that cargo piece will separate from Dream Chaser. That'll burn up in the atmosphere. And Dream Chaser will come back and land on a runway. So, a lot going on, Dick. Somehow ham radio's got to get involved in this. We need more ham radio. The space station is still active in that. Back to you.
On Tuesday of this week, Buzz Aldrin was at the book review bookstore in Huntington. I was tempted to go there and ask him some questions about his great enthusiasm about trying to talk NASA into going to Mars. He's written a number of books on that subject, given lots of lectures on that subject of we should be going to Mars. I was going to go and ask him some questions about how is he going to finance that. You were talking about going to visit Buzz Aldrin. I wonder if you had a chance to do that, Paul, and what do you have to say to you? WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
And I have an email question about something similar. Somebody just sent in, Dick, so if we have time, we'll try to broach that.
Yeah, I want to also to come back to the atomic structure and the heat exchange.
Go ahead, Paul. Did you get a chance to see Buzz Aldrin?
I couldn't make it when he was there, but I did get him to sign the book. So I do have a signed copy now. By the way, it's a pretty good book. I know where Wesley's waiting, and John had an email from somebody. Well, back to net control. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
So are you saying you got there after he left, but you still bought one of his books with the signature in it? You weren't there. He supposedly was going to begin at 7 p.m. Maybe you're saying you weren't able to get there at 7 p.m. on Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, I couldn't make it that night, but I have somebody I knew that was able to, they sign a couple. If you pay in advance, he'll sign a book for you. You know, it's one of those deals. You can do that with book signings. And that's what I did. So, when I went, not that day, but afterwards, and then was able to, they had my book for me, so I just had to give my receipt. I was good to go.
Okay, John, now what question have we gotten on the chat room or Echo Link? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB, yeah, the email just came in on topic. A young man would like to know and hear from both you and Paul. He would like to know, with the NASA still touting the Mars mission, and, you know, they say it's going to get done. His question is, with all of the private industry, it looks like the private industry will probably be the one doing it. He'd like to know if the logistic planning of how they're going to set it up, has anything changed? Are they going to, would they probably send habitat modules or maybe like mobilization trailers or whatever to Mars first and all of the food? And he would like to hear comments from both of you on that. And could it be in the next 50 years, do you think, Dick? Paul, maybe you've heard something or read something on the NASA website that might help this guy out. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Paul, you've been telling us that a number of the private industry spacecraft creators that have sprung up in the last couple of years are designing spacecraft with greater crew volume capability, more crew member capability, longer range capability, and so on. And they hint about the fact that some of these spacecraft have the capability of supporting a Mars mission. However, I'm of the opinion that that none of these commercial organizations have really said, hey, we've got a plan, we're going to do it in 25 years or something like that. That's my guess. Bring us up to date on that one, Paul. You've kept your ear a lot closer to the ground on this one than I have. WS2N, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Yeah, for actually bringing people to Mars. You know, we talk about it just on this net quite a bit, so who's ever listening out there? We could, this might change from month to month, but right now the present plan is for NASA, you know, old-fashioned NASA, no private industry involved. They're in charge, you know, they're paying private industry to build these things, but it's under their direction, just the way, you know, we built Mercury and Gemini and Saturn. They're building the SLS program, the Space Launch System, which is one humongous rocket. It's going to be more powerful than the Saturn V. And you'll look at the bottom of that rocket, you're going to see four RS-25 engines. RS-25 engines are the same engines that you used to see on the bottom of the space shuttle. And there were three on that. This one, four. But it will also have two of the world's largest solid booster rockets attached to it. The same company, Orbital ATK, is manufacturing that. The same solid booster rockets, similar, that were put on the space shuttle. And the difference is they were four segments, four cylinders bolted together. And this one's five. So you're going to have the taller solid booster rockets. Each one producing 3.6 million pounds of thrust, each solid booster rocket from the ground. That gives you a total of right there of, call it 7 million pounds of thrust. And then the four RS-25s that will be on the bottom of the SLS main rocket, which is fueled, by the way, similar to the space shuttle, which is liquid hydrogen, like we talked before, and liquid oxygen. Each engine is roughly a little over 500,000 pounds of thrust each, so that gives you another 2 million there. You're looking at a little over 9 million pounds of thrust between the, you know, for this whole rocket to get off the ground. All right, now on top of this, the spacecraft that's going to be utilized to go to Mars, present plan, is the Orion spacecraft. And you know, figure you're going to have four people on board, that's my guess. Four people will probably go up and eventually dock with a habitat type of module, whether that's going to be a mechanical thing or maybe a future Bigelow inflatable beam type of thing where you're going to be able to float inside and you're going to have this large area to go to Mars with. I don't know. Present estimate from NASA, all these rockets, these SLS rockets I was talking about, probably 30 or 40 will have to fly for a number of reasons, but mainly infrastructure. Trying to get a lot of stuff to Mars first. So this is going to be a complicated thing. It's going to take many years. Earliest, I'm going to say, earliest would be 2034. Okay, so will Elon Musk have a chance to beat them? I wouldn't be surprised the way this guy is. The fellow's a genius. But he's got plans not of the Falcon 9 doing it. That's way too small. He needs something bigger. If you look at the diameter of the Falcon 9, it's roughly 12 feet. Can you imagine a rocket roughly 30 feet or 33 feet in diameter with also nine engines, but each one way bigger than the Merlin D rocket. Each one of those
that are put on the bottom of the Falcon 9 rocket. So these are rockets. If you look it up on the internet, they're called the Raptor engine.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Okay, just let me finish the this whole rocket setup is going to be called Mars Colony Transport, MCT. And look for Elon Musk in September. This September, he's going to be talking down in Mexico to have some kind of a conference going on all about space. And that's his present plan to give his long-distance plan on how he's going to create a city on Mars. Take over to you. I hope that answers that fellow's question. Keep coming back month to month, year to year, and we'll give you a better update. It's very dynamic. WS2S.
Okay, Glenn.
1934 was your latest plan. I think that's going to be extended. Glenn, KC2QIQ. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Good evening, KC2QIQ. Yeah, actually, there was a briefing with Elon Musk after he did the revealing of the Tesla new version 3 that they put out, but he went on a little bit about his next plan for Mars, and his basic, what he was talking about there was to use the Falcon 9, but not for a human transport, but to do something that nobody's done yet. He wants to send a spacecraft to Mars, orbited very, very similar to what was done with the Apollo missions, and bring the rocket back and make sure that you can actually have a craft, make it there, navigate it back, get it back to Earth, and see first if that can be done first. So that's actually the first plan, and I believe he's planning on doing that within 5 years, Nick. K-Tor-I-W, KC2-QIQ.
That's amazing. I'm only going to give a couple of sentences on this, and that is, Mars at various portions of the mission is more than 1,000 miles, 1,000 times further away than the distance to the moon. The lunar program, manned lunar mission of Apollo, by the time we got to Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, cost something like $33 billion in 1970 money. And since Mars is 1,000 times further away, it's going to be close to 1,000 times more difficult, 1,000 times more expensive than $33 billion is $33 trillion. Now, Musk maybe is going to come up with crafty techniques to cut that price in half or one-third, but still one-half or one-third of $33 trillion is way beyond what private industry can finance and our government can finance. Therefore, let me drop. Therefore, from a pure pessimistic economic point of view, it's going to take the funding of many of your advanced nations, of your primary nations, to be able to finance this. And a number of those nations are going to say, if I give you 10% of my gross national product to send a man to Mars, what do I get for my money? They're going to ask that question. And that's a very difficult question. So the pure financing and the pure physics of bringing the right amount of fuel, food, water, and air, and to maintain a man in space takes the volume of your house and the mass of your house to maintain that man for 1 year. And you're going to send 4 men for 2 years. That's 8 man years. That's 8 houses worth of raw materials just to keep those men, giving them air, food, and water. So the physics of that plus the finances makes me a lot more pessimistic. You can send a Spirit any of these unmanned spacecraft to Mars, and with nuclear power they can walk around Mars for years at a time and gather a lot of information. And that unmanned craft is 10,000 times cheaper than a manned mission. So I'm skeptical. I wouldn't dare say it's absolutely impossible. I'm extremely skeptical that within my lifetime I'm going to see it. I'm not sure that my son is going to see a man on Mars in his lifetime. But that's my opinion. I'm telling you some of what my opinion is based on. Now, Wes, I know you want to discuss something about more about why the bottom of a bicycle pump gets hot. WS2N? N2XJN. K2LAW. Good.
Repeater. Time out.
You've got it, Wes.
You have a little bit of time. More puzzling. Stirling engine, which is being used in submarines because it's quiet and doesn't have any inlets and outlets. Also, the Peltier effect, which is actually when you have, it's a thermoelectric cooler, when you have a solid state heat pumps, they operate on the same effect. That means, let's say you have two conductors and they are dissimilar materials they're being used, so then when you put DC current on, they create the temperature difference, and then with the temperature difference, Peltier effect will make move the heat from one end of the conductor to the other. And by that, you were interested with the what atomic structure does. Let me jump. It's a thermoelectric cooler, which is made out of P and N type semiconductors elements that act as two dissimilar conductors, according to the Peltier. So it is possible to shift the balance of electrons and holes in the silicon crystal lattice by doping it, so different material, with other atoms. Atoms with one more valence electron than silicon are used to produce N-type semiconductor material, and atoms with less valence electrons result in P-type. So then what you do is when you have a lattice of the electrons, the grid, the area of the element, which is the piezoelectrical material, is soldered between two ceramic plates, electrically in series and thermally in parallel. As the DC current passes through one or more pairs of elements from N to P, there is a decrease in temperature at the junction, and that would be the cold side, resulting in the absorption of the heat from the environment. And the heat is carried through the cooler by electron transport and release on the opposite hot side, as the electrons move from the high to low energy state. And then the heat, say pumping capacity of that cooler, piezoelectric cooler, would be somehow proportional to the current and the number of pairs of N and P. Now, when you're talking about the piston, actually, before we go to the piston, there are, for the computers, piezoelectric coolers, they don't go too much, they go only to 3.4 degrees of Celsius in minus, which is not much. They are 4 millimeters tall, 50% slimmer than the traditional fans because they need to build the heat sink. You can buy them for $34 if you want. So far, it's a General Electric that makes them. So far, it's not good. I read the review. It was denial to that, to those kind of heaters. Some more stuff. History of the Stirling engine. It was 1918-16, Robert Stirling. At that time, they used the hot steam engines, and because they had a hot pressure cylinder, they wanted to prevent the explosion, and they were thinking that hot air may actually do that, and there was the engine designed by the gentleman. But then with the advent of the gasoline engines, they forgot about it. Only in 1938, Phillips Research Lab was looking for the means of generating electricity, and they took that forgotten technology, and they find out it's a beautiful cooling structure, and all modern coolers microwave coolers, for the telephony, for anything that is 77 minus 77 Kelvin, which is the liquid nitrogen. All of that stuff is right now made on based on the technology. And what's going on with the piston? Okay. Since the gas is at a higher temperature and of course the pressure, during its expansion when you have a piston, during the expansion, then during the compression, more power is produced during the expansion than is reabsorbed during the compression. So, at the next, the excess of power is useful in that engine. It looks like you have a dual piston structure, and actually they call it free piston right now. There are no valves, or there is no intermittent combustion in the structure. Everything is enclosed. So imagine that you have a cylinder and then you have two pistons, one of the opposite side of the cylinder. Everything is closed. So you could have a spring and you could magnetically try to do the vibration or the movement of those pistons, or you could do the diaphragm to do that. Then when you compress, you create the temperature, and then the heat sink is picking up the temperature, but then when the piston is moving the other way, because there is a gas inside, is actually pushing the other piston from the other side back to the other side of the cylinder. Now there is less heat in there, and there is the space between them is acts like a conditioner. The older version of the cylinder engine had something like a flywheel with the two rods that were separately driving the pistons, so it's a dual piston. So that's all. Back to you, Antoine.
When it comes to cryogenically cooling low noise transistors, there was for a period of time a triple stacked Peltier cooler. It looked like a wedding cake. There was a small Peltier cooler right on the transistor, well insulated, and that sat on top of a larger Peltier cooler, which took the heat out of the first one, plus the transistor, and so on. So a triple stacked Peltier cooler. I think they were able to get numbers like 150 degrees centigrade of cooling altogether. That puts you in the right direction. But when it comes to liquid nitrogen cooling, which is 77 degrees Kelvin compared to 290 room temperature, liquid nitrogen can get you numbers like 223 degrees of cooling, and triple Peltier can only get you 150 or so. So it helps, but you can't get all the way. If you want to have cryogenically cooled, let me drop transistors or state-of-the-art Macer amplifiers, you really want liquid nitrogen and liquid helium cooling. Liquid helium is around 4 degrees Kelvin. So to electronically get there is difficult. There is something called the, Stirling engine? Joule Thompson refrigerator. Joule Thompson refrigerator, rather expensive, can get you to those liquid nitrogen, liquid helium type temperatures. Too bad they're so expensive. Somebody's got to find a cheaper way of doing that.
I have 4 Kelvin.
What was that again?
I have 4 Kelvin in my house.
Okay, is that done by a Joule Thompson refrigerator? And my guess is that refrigerator, if you had to buy it brand new, is quite pricey. Is that true, Wes?
That's correct. The only thing is that there is also additional module of the Peltier. So it's a Peltier, it's a Joule Thompson, and it does have an element of the Stirling engine as well. So I have two stages in it, and then the liquid the helium is being used as a drive First stage is giving me about 33 Kelvin, and the other one is giving me 4 Kelvin. And thank you.
Now, in the past, if you're not very careful with the way you use a Joule Thompson refrigerator, they did in the past have limited reliability. Maybe that has gotten better these days. What's your guess as to the reliability and the number of hours of service it will give you before it requires refurbishing over US K2LIW?
Joule Thompson usually goes to 120,000-150,000 hours. The one that I've got has 156 hours on it. It comes with the chamber that I told you about for testing the electronic devices. And to exchange.
Got about 1 minute, Dick.
So you have 4 degrees Kelvin in your house. You may be the only person in the county of Queens that can do that. How big a chamber can you maintain at 4 degrees Kelvin, and how much heat load could it tolerate? If you had a low noise transistor in there that's giving off 20 milliwatts of heat, would your system still be able to maintain 4 degrees Kelvin, Wes? N2XJN, K2LIW?
Yeah, I believe so. The chamber is quite big. Is approximately 20 inches tall and approximately 8 inches across. And the per tier, not a per tier, the cooling, top of the cooling head, the cold finger is being cooled, has a approximately 8 double plates, which is 1 inch by thick by 4 inches long by 2 inches wide copper plate where I can mount whatever I want, and that part is actually holding for Kelvin. Now, interesting thing is that I mentioned that submarines are using Stirling engines right now because there's extra quiet. Back to you.
Yeah, that's amazing. And you must have all of that volume at 4 degrees Kelvin must have some really fantastic insulation. Otherwise, you'd be building up liquid air and ice and everything else on us. Wow. Next week, you're going to have to tell us what your intention is to do with this cryogenic system you just described to us. That's very unusual temperature for somebody in a private home to have. That's usually a extremely well-equipped laboratory, which is, I guess, what you've got there in Queens. You guys have just heard TechNet number 1597. You've heard Space Report 196. We intend to be back next week. I keep your questions coming. I'm going to turn it over to John and Paul in that order. KC2WGB, and roughly how many people did you see on the Echo Link or any of your other links tonight? How many people were listening at least for some short period of time tonight, Paul? I mean, John, KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Dick, tonight we have about 8 on Echo Link, and you know, they come in and out, and 4 or 5 on the chat room, and a few emails that had come in the meantime. But pretty good attendance. And tonight I'd like to thank everybody for joining us and for the questions that were submitted. And I hope you all can come back next week and we'll start it all over again. Good stuff and interesting. So everybody be well and have fun. Paul, good night. Dick, you have a wonderful week, and we will do it again. KC2WGB. Paul, pick it up, sir.
Yeah, when I get a chance, John, I'm going to ask you whether or not you started the construction of that symmetric dipole feed for your feed horn. Paul, it sounds like an awful lot is going on in space. My goodness. All these countries, all of these private companies, all of these space agencies. My goodness, is that airspace and that vacuum around the planet Earth. Boy, is it being filled up with a whole lot of particles of stuff. And we're adding more to it every hour. We're adding more to it, Paul. How do they keep track of it all? WS2N, K2RIW.
KC2QIQ.
Okay.
Okay, and very good. And what Glenn was saying before, we'll research that later next week. But I think that's, I know there was something called the Red Dragon that was conceptual. And I know he wanted to fly the Falcon 9 Heavy. And he wanted to land the Dragon on Mars. And this is after the robot from NASA goes up, the 2020 rover, and have a sample return. I wonder if that's what he was talking about, but we'll talk about more. I know Glenn wanted to get it. So 73, we'll talk to you next week on Annette. Back to you, Dick.
You've got it, Glenn.
Yeah, just keeping in line with what Elon Musk was doing, I think the reason why he was poked into doing it was there's a company in Boston called Boldly Go Institute. They're planning in 2018 to send a craft into Mars orbit, collect space dust, and return back to Earth. So, of course, this Boston company, Elon Musk, couldn't be outdone. So I think that's why he stepped up to the plate. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ. And I actually do have something else to mention to you if you have a couple seconds.
Does that Boston company have any track record, any demonstrated capability of doing something even close to that, Doug Glenn? Go ahead.
Well, it's actually, I think they're saying it's a Colorado-based nonprofit, but apparently it's, this whole thing started in Boston, but it somehow has some Colorado-based nonprofit tied to it. But and they're saying that it's extremely doable. So apparently they mentioned this in the astronomical meeting in Boston, and that's what kicked this off.
That sounds like a $500 million project. How in the world do you finance that? How do you convince your backers to put $500 million what would you call it now? I can't. These guys who fund crazy projects, what are they going to get in return? A handful of dust. You got another question, Glenn? Go ahead.
I just wanted to mention a funny story to you. The engineering handbooks. I wound up purchasing on eBay all four editions, and actually quite good. And what was funny was that when the second edition was supposed to come on eBay, and the book that came in its place was a book by Krauss, which I was expecting the second edition, but they made a mistake and they sent me the Krauss book on antennas, which is also a very good book. So I had to wind up going around to buy the second edition again. But I wound up with about 20 pounds of books right now for under $100. It's a beautiful thing, Dick. I just think I'd run that by you. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
WS2N, one comment to you, Dick.
You know, when it comes to Krauss, Krauss has three editions of his book called Antennas. Go ahead, Wes. Paul, WS2N, K2RIW, and then pass it over to Glenn.
I haven't been over to Northern Huntington and all. It's got to be over 10 years. It got very busy over there. And plus, I was there. It was raining. Very busy, Dick. Past that Walt Whitman Mall and all. Wow. Back to you.
Yeah, but where you're starting off at Ronkonkoma, to go all the way over to Route 110 and then up is a long way to go. I'm a little bit amazed you didn't go by 25A and some other route, if you know what I mean, to get to downtown Huntington. Glenn, you had another comment. Go ahead, Glenn.
Sorry, I thought about that as I was driving, Dick.
I actually didn't have another comment, Dick, but I'm looking for the edition on this Krauss book, but it does say that this is 1950, but it doesn't say what the edition is. I'm sure it does somewhere. I just don't have, this is, my goodness, I'm not sure. I can find the edition.
There is no edition. 1950 is the first edition of Krauss's book called Antennas. The second edition was somewhere around 1970, 1980, and the third edition is another decade after that. So the first edition won't say it's the first edition. They didn't know there's going to be two more editions, Glenn. 1950, McGraw-Hill, that was his first. That's a classic.
And let's just put it this way. I was a little disappointed to see that I didn't get the second edition of the Antenna Handbook at the time that I ordered it. It was like $14. But when this came, I was kind of actually, it was a nice surprise. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Now, the Antenna Engineering Handbook comes in four separate editions. Oh, I think the third edition is arguably the best one for the money. The fourth edition has 400 more.